akhlaq is a must because our ibadah depends on it. So we can't go to Allah with one and leaving the other. Many people, sadly, seem to have it sometimes the other way around. They have the highest level of akhlaq. They are perfect in terms of akhlaq. They're kind, generous, loving, giving, and everything else. When it comes to in terms to ibadah, they have nothing. And that's why sometimes we see this misconception with the Muslims when they look at the West. They say, well, look at them. They are perfect Muslims. They just don't have Islam. Well, sadly, that's wrong. Because we, as we said previously, al-akhlaq are embedded into every human being. So they're not doing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala a favor by showing their akhlaq, which it has to be there in the first place. So for a person to be commanded or at least, you know, gratified for his akhlaq, he needs to have what? Amal in towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's why when we look at the Quran, not a single verse found in the Quran where Allah says, Alladhina amanu, without attaching amilu. So you need ilm and you need iman and amal all together. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala needs a person, on top of the fact that he has all these good traits, he needs to have the iman in Allah which leads him to do worship acts. We cannot separate the two. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will not accept, even in the Quran says, those who are do not come to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with Islam, Allah will not accept it. Because Allah wants the religion, which is Islam, which is made of two parts, akhlaq and actions and amal when it comes to worship. So don't be deceived because a person is good, because a person has high level of morals. It doesn't mean Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to say, well, there you go, you know, free green ticket to heaven. He's still missing a part. Yes, sometimes if we have to compare those who have akhlaq compared to those who don't, we say, yes, they are a little bit better. In terms of Allah's acceptance, it's a different matter altogether, which inshallah we will talk about later on. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Shedding tears of joy after years of longing for the chance to visit a land described as the land of revelation in the Holy Quran. Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, or the city of the Prophet, as it hosts the final resting place of the Prophet Muhammad. Direct flights from Iran arrive in Saudi cities of Medina and Jeddah and will continue until 4th of July. A large number of Iranian pilgrims will first stay in Medina for 6 days and five nights to visit the Prophet's Mosque and the Baqi Cemetery, among other sites, before leaving for Mecca to perform the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
Being in a place that the Holy Prophet Muhammad and her daughter Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein had been is an amazing spiritual experience.
I've been to lots of holy shrines, but here I feel different. I feel absolute peace and detached from the world.
The outbreak of the coronavirus limited trips to Mecca and Medina for 2 years, with only a limited number of Saudi pilgrims being allowed to perform it over the period. Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, while many of them have been awaiting for as long as 15 years. Going around the Prophet's mosque, you can see Iranians overwhelmed with emotions, most of them describing their visit to Medina as a unique experience.
It's impossible to describe the atmosphere in the Prophet's mosque. You can't understand how it feels until you visit the mosque.
I feel God has bestowed His blessing upon me to be the pilgrim of the Prophet's tomb and be in this spiritual environment. It's truly exceptional.
In 2019, the last Hajj before the outbreak of the coronavirus, about 85,000 Iranian pilgrims visited Saudi Arabia. But this year, with the reduction of quotas in Islamic countries, nearly 40,000 people from Iran are allowed to participate in the annual event.
Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, and many more are on their way to get to this holy city. This is while many more Iranians, thousands, have to wait for at least another year so that they maybe get the chance to visit this holy city once in their life. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Drama Theatre of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theatre.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still really dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in. It's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick,
due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
Behind me is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theatre as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theatre. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti, but much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the seven-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons.
People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and the children to enter Yemen. Abdul Latif Lwashali, Sana'a.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day.
No, no, no.
Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up. And the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers.
Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot. And they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost of living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. And that has meant scenes like this. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework, but the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact the strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say a major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Saeed Purizup, London.
Afghanistan, the axis of regional stability and cooperation is the title of this seminar that hosts political figures and experts from Afghanistan and neighboring countries. The event aims to discuss ways Afghanistan and neighboring countries can boost peace and integration in the region.
Afghanistan has experienced almost four decades of war, conflict, and invasion. But with recent political changes, the country is opening a new chapter in its history. Therefore, Afghanistan's priorities, policy, and engagement must be reviewed. Our relations with neighbors is one of these elements of regional stability and development. New Afghan rulers must boost ties and dialogues with regional states to prevent the foreign powers from another interference and invasion.
Representatives from neighboring countries also announced their readiness for providing needed assistance for the Afghan nation, stressing the need for lasting peace in Afghanistan.
Iran and Afghanistan have had long bilateral relations in different areas, especially in the health sector. Iran has helped the Afghan nation with establishing clinics and hospitals across Afghanistan, as well as providing medicines. Iran is also training Afghan doctors and health staff inside Afghanistan or giving them scholarships for Iranian universities.
In the meantime, Taliban leaders attending the seminar say that Afghanistan is strongly in favor of promoting regional cooperation in different fields.
The Islamic Emirate is committed to establish positive and fair relations with regional countries, especially our neighbors. In return, we expect the world and regional countries to help Afghans and Afghanistan. Talking about potential cooperation opportunities, I should say that Afghanistan is a bridge in the region. If they assist us, we can establish air corridors or construct streets and railways to help promote regional trade.
The Taliban-led interim government has not yet been recognized by world countries, but the neighbors of Afghanistan have held several meetings to emphasize the need for stability in Afghanistan and helping Afghan people. After decades of war, Afghanistan is stepping into a new era, gearing up for regional integration and cooperation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
French President Emmanuel Macron's coalition has been reprimanded at the ballot box in the second round legislative vote, failing to secure an absolute majority. However, he and the longtime Conservative Party are expected to continue to unite on neoliberal policies, and combined, they will control over half of parliament, with initial projections giving them 53%.
This is a country which is difficult to govern, with a lot of different demands. I don't see there being a big change for the average person over the next 5 years, but I do foresee a lot of difficulties.
In his first term, Macron routinely forced policies through by executive decree, even though he had a comfortable absolute majority, causing many to see the legislative vote as an empty formality. Thus, turnout reached just 46%, making abstention the real Democratic majority winner.
Voter participation was far from excellent, unfortunately. Hopefully, it won't hurt the credibility of the government when it comes to implementing reform.
The biggest winner was the far-right National Front, who more than doubled most poll predictions with around 90 seats, making them the third largest power in parliament and tripling their best score ever. When the results were announced, their election headquarters immediately chanted, "Macron resign," and they will likely play an unpredictable role in mainstream politics. The left-wing NUPES, Popular Front Alliance, promised much and under-delivered. With only 25% of seats, they are the main opposition party, but are small enough to be easily brushed aside by the right wing. The new kingmakers are the mainstream conservative party, but Macron's record of legalizing Islamophobia, far-right economic policies, often passed via authoritarian decree, and his brutal repression of the Yellow Vests has caused many to say for years that Macron is actually a mainstream conservative, but with a new party logo. Despite a prolonged period of once-in-a-century social unrest, the French political landscape has barely been changed. If essentially the same people in power don't change how they govern, many say the next 5 years could be dangerously explosive. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
EU leaders held video calls throughout Tuesday to prepare for a summit on Thursday and Friday, at which Ukraine and Moldova will be granted candidate status, which means they move a step closer to joining the 27-country bloc. Georgia will be placed to a stage just below candidate status. EU affairs ministers also met on Tuesday to lay the groundwork.
That's, I think, a very important message. And it's a very important message which comes in a special time where we see this renewed geopolitical rivalry new global tensions.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted, "Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream." Not everyone is impressed, given the current state of the EU.
I'd say the Ukrainians would rather live than die. And I'd say now the notion that they want to die for any European dream is a bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard, not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc. In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Britain's cost of living crisis is being made worse by Brexit dragging down the country's growth potential and costing workers hundreds of pounds a year in lost pay. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's economics correspondent Richard Partington. The piece is titled "Brexit is making cost of living crisis worse," new study claims. Britain's cost of living crisis is being made worse by Brexit, dragging down the country's growth potential and costing British workers hundreds of pounds a year in lost pay, according to new research. The Resolution Foundation think tank and academics from the London School of Economics have said the average worker in Britain was now on course to suffer more than £470 in lost pay each year by 2030, after rising living costs are taken into account compared with a Remain vote in 2016. In a report 6 years on from the referendum, the researcher said Brexit was damaging the competitiveness of United Kingdom exports on the world stage, just as companies are forced to deal with the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic and Russia's conflict with Ukraine, pushing inflation to historic levels. A less open Great Britain is expected to be poorer and less productive, the new research claimed. Official figures due on Wednesday are expected to show a fresh rise in the inflation rate from 9% in April to 9.1% last month, as surging petrol prices and the rising cost of a weekly shop ramps up the pressure on struggling families. The Bank of England has warned the inflation rate could reach as high as 11% by October. As the government attempted to face down rail unions on Tuesday, 21st of June, amid the most widespread train strike since the 1980s, ministers were forced to defend inflation-busting increases planned for the state pension, while ordering pay restraint for workers in the public sector. The former Conservative Chancellor, Ken Clark, said Britain was in the grip of the worst economic crisis since at least 1979, telling the BBC that a recession was almost inevitable. Kenneth Clark said, "We are, I think, almost certainly going to go into recession in the next couple of years. The Bank of England has had to start tackling inflation, which has been allowed to get completely out of hand." Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned workers against asking for bigger pay rises to prevent a 1970s-style wage-price spiral, driving inflation higher, in sharp contrast to October of last year, when the Prime Minister suggested Brexit could help create a high-wage, high-productivity economy of the future. However, the new report from the Resolution Foundation and the London School of Economics said Brexit would weigh heavily on productivity gains over the coming years up to 2030, while suggesting that higher import costs were adding to pain for household finances. The new research estimated labour productivity, a key measure of economic output per hour of work, could be reduced by as much as 1.3% by 2030 because of a decline in openness of the British economy after Brexit, equivalent to losing a quarter of efficiency gains achieved over the past decade. Ministers have argued bigger pay rises for British workers would only be sustainable if backed by productivity gains. However, with the expected decline in the efficiency of the British economy after Brexit, the academics said inflation-adjusted pay was now set for a 1.8% fall by 2030. It said this was equivalent to the loss of £472 for a worker in a year. The report's authors included the London School of Economic academics Swati Dhingra, an outspoken Brexit critic picked by the Chancellor Rishi Sunak to sit on the Bank of England's Interest Rate Setting Monetary Policy Committee from August. The report appeared to undermine the government's argument that Brexit and its plans to level up the economy to boost prosperity outside of London and the South East, with researchers finding the northeast of England would be hardest hit by leaving the European Union. With a bigger industrial sector and higher exposure to the European Union market, it said the region would see a 2.7% fall in manufacturing output by 2030. Compared with a scenario in which the United Kingdom voted to remain in the European Union in 2016. Although the report found that exports to the European Union had not been as heavily hit by Brexit under the terms of Boris Johnson's trade deal with Brussels since the start of last year, it nonetheless warned overall that Britain would become less open and less competitive. Exports to the European Union are expected to be 38% lower than they would have been inside the European Union by 2030, with a further 16% decline due to foregone further integration with the European Union over that period. Thorsten Bell, the chief executive of the Resolution Foundation, said Brexit would make recovering from the COVID pandemic and getting wages to rise sustainably after the cost of living crisis more difficult. Thorsten Bell said, 10% inflation is painful, whether you drive a train, commute by train, or have nothing to do with trains. It would always have been hard to cope with, but it is far more so for families coming on the back of 15 years of stagnant wages. The sustainable route out of this is stronger, productivity-led wage growth. COVID-19 and Brexit don't make that any easier to achieve, but Britain has considerable economic strength and we urgently need a renewed economic strategy that builds on them.
We come to this point that Sheikh Shaltut, good communication with Ayatollah Burujerdi in Iran, give this picture that how the head of Al-Azhar is establishing relationship and communication with the head of Shia in the world of Islam.
One of the very important points that Sheikh Shaltut insisted on it is that tried to have the gathering and the mourning ceremony for the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in the day of Ashura in Al-Azhar University.
Be more familiar with outstanding figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Mahtavi.
Alaikum assalamu wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalamu wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding Muslim figure from the Ahl Sunnah, from our Sunni brethren, who had role in establishing proximity among the different schools of thoughts of Islam inside the religion Islam, also one of the main founders of Darul Taqrib Bain al-Mazahib al-Islami. He is no one but Mahmoud Shaltut, mainly known as Sheikh Shaltut, the outstanding university professor and the scholar of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some details about the early life of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, born in 23rd April 1893. He was an Egyptian figure best known for his attempts in terms of Islamic reform and also Islamic unity, bringing about unification among different sects of Islam, mainly Shia and Sunni. Sheikh Shaltut, he was from one of the villages of the province Behira, actually from one of the villages of the Behira province in Egypt. And he completed his study in Alexandria, which was one of the affiliated religious institute of Al-Azhar. Since he was a very talented student, he was invited to Al-Azhar University to complete his study. So he received his bachelor in Al-Azhar and finished off his degree, PhD in Al-Azhar.
So it was really important to be invited to Al-Azhar by the head or vice chancellor of the university at that time, who was Mustafa Al-Maraghi.
That's right.
He was invited to the University of Al-Azhar, and he had a very good cooperation with the head of the university because he believed and trusted Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut as one of the talented student and smart student. So I think this is a very important part of his life that we have to give more focus and thought, because later on, inshallah, when we discuss about the achievements being done and conducted by Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, we are really in need of knowing that he was a very talented, smart student that graduated from Al-Azhar, and he was not a kind of normal student to graduate from the university. Why I'm saying these stuff, because when we reach, inshallah, later on in the following parts of our discussion for today, we will talk about the great and outstanding role that he, this student, played in the world of Islam.
That's right. Okay, thank you, Sheikh Mahdawi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, give us a picture of his Taghribi attempts. I mean, because his main, I think, interest was Taghrib al-Madhahib, and the look that he had at Jafariya School of Thought in that time made him very much famous among the Shiites. School of Thought too, one of our Sunni brethren, you know, gave us a fatwa or a jawaz, a permission that we can say acting and practicing Islam according to the Jafariya School of Thought is allowed, and this and that. I think this made the role of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut very much great. But what was happening before him, I mean, in the world of Islam? First give us that picture, and then we'll get to the attempts of Sheikh Shaltut himself.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my dear brother Sheikh Mahdawi mentioned, before Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh Mustafa Al-Maraghi was the head of Al-Azhar University in Egypt. And we should know this, that Al-Azhar was a university,
yes,
but it was not an ordinary one, because the head of Al-Azhar was chosen by the president of Egypt directly.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not ordinary in educational system that a president appoints the head of a university. But because Al-Azhar was a flag of Islam at that moment, and even nowadays it is, so it was in that high importance, in that level of importance, that the president of Egypt himself was appointing the chief and the head of this university. So this shows the importance of this university. Before Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh Mustafa Al-Maraghi was the head of this university.
Yes.
And we should notice, and we should know this point, that the attempts of Taghrib and trying to get the scholars and the sects of Islam closer to each other, these attempts was started at the time of Sheikh Mustafa Al-Maraghi. And Sheikh Shaltut also was a teacher in Al-Azhar on that moment. He was amongst those ones who were doing their best to collect these scholars and to let them sit beside each other and have dialogue.
That's right.
But the most important event took place during the time of Sheikh Shaltut.
That's right.
And that was after the establishment of Darut Taghrib. Because Darut Taghrib was the center that was established at the time of Sheikh Mustafa Al-Maraghi. Mm-hmm. And Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut was also one of the scholars who were amongst the organizers and the establishers, those ones who put the milestone and the, you know, starting point of this,
Foundation.
Yeah.
An institution, that's right.
Institution, yeah.
Okay.
So after establishment of Darut Taghrib, that we may discuss about it later, this movement started. And day by day, having these dialogues, the scholars came to this point that, okay, we may have some differences, but the common points are much more than the differences that we have.
Right.
So that's why they came to this point that, okay, let us highlight and put emphasis on the common points and also have scholarly discussions
about the differences that we have. But let us forget about fighting each other.
That's right.
Let us forget about, you know, addressing each other as infidel or kafir or mushrik or, you know, some words like this that make people angry and make them to have, you know, severe actions against each other.
Sorry, was the atmosphere on that time over the wall of Islam like today? I mean, the Takfiri ones were in power, or the Wahhabism?
Sure, yeah.
It wasn't...
You know, okay. The starting point of Darut Taghrib was this.
Mm-hmm.
A Shia Muslim in the Masjid al-Haram.
Yes.
He went for doing Hajj,
yes.
Baytullah al-Haram. And during Hajj, he faced with problem, you know, health problem, and he vomited
mm-hmm.
inside Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
And the guards of Masjid al-Haram, they took him, arrested him, and put him in court. And they accused him of disrespecting Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
And the judge, because he was Shia, they said that he was kafir, and he had done this action intentionally inside Masjid al-Haram.
Okay.
So the verdict was execution. And the man was executed inside Mecca. So it was really a shocking news to the Muslim world.
On that time, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
It's something about 10, 15, or the maximum is 20 years before start the establishment of Darut Taghrib.
Okay.
So it shows the atmosphere of Muslim world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That hatred is among some Muslims in a way that they are accusing a sick man
mm-hmm.
that he unintentionally had vomited inside Masjid al-Haram, but they have executed him
mm-hmm.
because of this action.
Really harsh sentence for
a man. So, yeah. In this atmosphere, Sheikh Shaltut is trying to get sects beside each other, closer to each other, and putting them under the same umbrella. So that's why this, you know, efforts are really notable and important.
Very good, very good. Really nice efforts from his side. So how did he do it? So in such an atmosphere, in Egypt and Al-Azhar, you know, and we know that socio-political affairs are also playing their roles in the society. So I think Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut's responsibility was really difficult, isn't it, to establish a dialogue between our Sunni brethren and the Shia ones. How did he do it?
Yes, that is a good question. When we read the history, we see that this was not something to take place haphazardly.
Yes.
All of the sudden, you see that such a man is trying to issue the verdict mm-hmm. in order to include Shia as the Muslim sect.
Yes.
Actually, as a
Shia was official. A Muslim sect officially, okay.
Officially.
Yes.
Officially, mm-hmm. because this is a very important point, specifically for Sunnis.
Yes.
Why? Because all things that today we see, excommunicating of yes. Shias, this is because of the verdict that allowed them, considering Shias mm-hmm. out of the Islam. Then they kill. Then they go to executing people. Why?
Yes.
Because they consider them as non-Muslim. So mm-hmm. if they are mushrik, if they are kafir, this act of excommunication
yes.
takes place under this ideology that Shia are not included under Muslim sects.
So we should say that even to non-Muslim such behaviors are condemned, okay, let alone to the Muslims. Okay.
Yes. So we see that such achievements didn't take place all of the sudden. So when we read the history and the biography of Sheikh Shaltut, we see besides these actions, he was really active in both sides and both grounds, both in theory and action.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of theory and spreading the theory of Wahda and unification, we see how he started or established the chair for Fiqh al-Muqaran. What is the concept of Fiqh al-Muqaran?
Yes, it
is a comparative study on the Fiqh, jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm.
So it will enable students to know about other Fiqh as well. It is not only to read and study Fiqh Ahl-Sunnah.
Mm-hmm.
When you are talking about Fiqh al-Muqaran, it enables students to get to know about the jurisprudence of other sects of Islam, like Zaydis or Shias.
Okay.
So when they go and study Shia jurisprudence, they will find on their own that there are a lot of similarities that they are not told about it. So this opportunity to bring about this opportunity and chances for the student and new generation to get to know about other sects will pave the ground for the moment that you want to establish the unity in the ground. I mean, in action. Okay. So this is one of the things that he did. And besides this, we have to say that the good communication that he had with Ayatollah Burujerdi in Iran, who would consider as the main leader or marja in Iran.
Alam.
Yes, of the Shia.
Yes.
So this is also one of the good action which give this picture that if those people, meaning Shia, are not considered as Muslim, if they are deserve to be treated that way that my brother mentioned in Mecca, how the head of Al-Azhar is establishing relationship and communication with the head of Shia in the world of Islam. So we have to look at these actions that he took. Yes. So when we read the history, we come to this point that Sheikh Shaltut, he was not only the man of speech or talking or only talking about the theories.
Yes.
We know how it is difficult to take the political stance specifically against Israel. So he was one of the people who took a very severe stance against the invasion of Israel. And interestingly, after the arrest of Ayatollah Khomeini, Imam Khomeini, before the revolution, it was known of Ayatollah Khomeini, in the demonstration of June 1963, he also took a very harsh stance against the Shah of Iran. He made a telegraph to the Shah of Iran that you are not allowed to disrespect. So these kind of action, if we put all of them all together, will pave the ground for Sheikh Shaltut and will give him this position to lead this movement, I mean the movement of unity and unification among the Shia sects. So based on what I said at the beginning of this discussion, we also must take into consideration one very important point. What is that point? Is that all these actions are taking place when he is reaching his 60s. So at that time, he is a mature, knowledgeable
man.
He was not a young man to say because of getting excited of some sort of news, he had taken these actions. And at that time, when he was 63, he was leading Al-Azhar University. So having all those knowledge about Sunnism, including Shia as one of the Muslim sects, and issuing this verdict publicly that no one has right to disrespect them. Even you can actually lead your salat behind them. You can pray your salat behind them.
Even he did it behind
Ayatollah himself
did it.
So these actions empowered him of getting this position in the world of Islam.
That's all right. Very good. Very great achievements by Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut. He has also several books. The most outstanding one is a tafsir. I think this taqribi look, I think, can be seen in his tafsir or exegesis of the Holy Quran too. Okay, Sheikh Ziyanya, your final words about him. Do you have anything to say?
Beside all these efforts that my dear brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, we should notice that acting in accordance with your beliefs is not easy, and you should take hard steps. And Sheikh Shaltut took these steps. For example, Majma' al-Bayan is a very famous exegesis on Holy Quran written by Marhum At-Tabarsi Rahmatullah Alayh. And Majma' al-Bayan is a tafsir in which we see that the theories and the ideas of Sunni scholars are also reflected in this tafsir. And Sheikh Shaltut, according to a wise decision, decided to write an introduction for this tafsir. So he introduced Majma' al-Bayan to the world of Sunni scholars that look, this is a Shia tafsir, this is a Shia commentary on the Holy Quran, and it's full of the ideas of Sunni scholars. So how do you blame these this school of thought to be, you know, not a part of Islam, while their scholars are reflecting our ideas? Besides this, one of the very important points that Sheikh Shaltut insisted on it and tried to break the atmosphere against this action is that, you know, the day of Ashura amongst some of Sunni communities or some of Sunni Muslims is known as Eid.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, okay.
And many of them, they are not aware of the event that took place in this day.
Yes.
I've even witnessed myself in different countries in Africa that people are not aware of the story that took place in this day. And they say, okay, this is the day of fasting. That's why Sheikh Shaltut tried to have the gathering and the mourning ceremony for the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam in the day of Ashura in Al-Azhar University.
Very good.
And this is very important, mm-hmm. that in the heart of the ideology of Sunni school of thought, that is Al-Azhar,
okay.
you held a ceremony for the sake of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam, the grandson of the Holy Prophet, and to keep the memory of the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, to make people aware of what happened.
That's right.
And to let them know that, okay, be respectful toward the grandson of Holy Prophet.
Yes.
So Sheikh Shaltut was taking very wise steps in this regard, mm-hmm. forgetting about the differences, of course, not neglecting. There are some, you know, differences, but overlooking the differences and try to highlight the common points as Quran tells us regarding the our inner relationship with non-Muslims. قُلْ يَا أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ تَعَالَوْا إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ أَلَّا نَعْبُدَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ. So it's more emphasis regarding the Muslims themselves. So if we have to talk with non-Muslims, it's obvious that yes. we are more in need to have dialogue with Muslims. So Sheikh Shaltut was amongst those figures that did his best in this regard and paid also for this
That's
way.
Right.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his soul.
And also paved the way, I think, for the next generation of yeah. the, you know, coming generation of Sunni brethren to establish dialogue with our Shiite ones around the world. And this is a look that Islam really needs in today's world in order to forget the bias, prejudice, you know, and extremism and get to the main pillars of Islam. Thank you very much. About his demise, 1963, coinciding with 1383, according to the Hijra calendar, he passed away in Cairo in Egypt and was buried over there. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyania and Sheikh Mahdavi, for a nice elaboration on the life of Sheikh Mahmoud Shaltut, one of the most outstanding Sunni brethren and one of the establishers of Dar al-Taghrib Bayn al-Mazahib al-Islami. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanil.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.